And it's, you know, now, for the most part, if you go to any kind of source material, almost no one says whether or not the bubble will burst. It's all primarily a matter of when, and you know what will be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Because again, they can't stop. They're on a treadmill. They need to feed this monster, and they'll feed them until it's physically impossible. Until there's no one out there to go for billions of dollars in case it works, you know, we'll make a load of money. It's becoming impossible. There's already more than $1 trillion in cluster rep. And eventually, when it dawns on everyone that there's no method at this time or even next year or the following year to monetize it for $1 trillion, if you gather up all of the income of all of these companies based on artificial intelligence, at best it's only in the billions, and that's not $1 trillion. So, you know, there's going to be no way to pay back all the money that they borrowed with the technology that they have today. They're not really promoting that. They're always saying that next year it's going to be amazingly different. And the problem is, it most likely is not going to be. There's going to be diminishing returns. When you finally plot this curve, you will see a stark wall that it hits. And a lot of people just wondering what's going to trigger it and how long it's going to take. It's incredibly unstable, and they're already having a real hard time getting new guys to throw in billions of dollars. It's getting exponentially more difficult to con people. So that kind of leads to the inevitable crash.
Yeah, it's a familiar scenario, the one you're describing throughout the banking industry, where I forgot exactly how it was phrased, but when you borrow money from the bank, they own you, but when you borrow a lot of money from the bank, you own them. That's not, as you know. Better than I. That's not the first time that's happened. I'm fully grasping what you're saying, because there's so much at stake keeping this thing going, and it is in the interest of these banks with very, very long reserves and large pockets to keep it going. That inevitably, you know, it sounds like it will fail, but they can keep it going for quite a while, and they may surprise us how long it takes. But very interesting. Thanks again, Roy, for those insights.
You're welcome, John. Yeah, they call that being too big to fail. But I mean, unfortunately, this isn't. You can't kind of put it standby mode. It's a runaway train. Once you run out of money, and they spend money like, you know, everyone, including Elon. I think the story was that every 6 weeks, XAI swallows $1 billion, another $1 billion. So, yeah, 1 year, about $12 billion or such. I don't think the banks or anyone else are going to be able to quite extend this trouble as long as they were able to do, say, the real estate bubble. This is a lot more like the dot-com bubble, including the fact that there's a lot of circular financing going on, that OpenAI gives money to NVIDIA, that gives NVIDIA then gives the money to Anthropic then gives it to Meta, and around and around, and then there's a bunch of side cycles of people who are building server farms all over the country. Finally, small towns and such are refusing to allow them to build these massive server farms in their area. Politicians probably getting paid off and such, all they're getting is more pollution and higher electric utility bills. So I don't know. I think it's going to come to a head sometime this year, but I can't tell you what's going to be the final straw, because, you know, that's the nature of things. You weaken the bridge, you weaken the bridge, you weaken the bridge, and then eventually, you know, a dog or a cat cross the bridge and the bridge collapses on it.
Yeah, you know, as you were laying out that whole financial circle, which, you know, which again is not new. I remember with the with that whole bond fiasco, where then they started to what they call those, the junk bonds, and then they're wrapping them and this and that and selling them off as different products. And I remember it got to the point where nobody could really say who owned what. And unfortunately, from what you're laying out here, the way now it's, you know, it's a similar method, but it seems to be involving more of a wider, a whole tech industry involvement, and where, you know, it's probably going to be the pension funds and everyone else in the end, because it seems it's going to drag down a lot with it. It's not going to be an isolated, event. It's not a surgical hole that it is now. It's going to be a big sinkhole.
Yeah, I think you were alluding to a derivative bond, which got so convoluted, confusing, that no one in a financial position could explain to anyone else what they exactly were. They got so bent and twisted around. But the problem is that all these pension programs invest in the stock market, and the most active and profitable stock in the S&P, I think there's something like 80 or 90% of the gains in the SE are based on nine companies that, you know, have been passing money around. You know, this cycle, a cyclical scheme, is sort of like, you know, if I went over to you and I gave you $10 and you accepted it, and then you handed me $10 back and I handed you the $10 again, and we did this 100 or 200 times and announced to everyone that we just made $2,000. And, you know, all we had was the $10 bill between us.
Yeah. Somebody wrote a brief thing, I read, and it was very interesting. It was, with the credit cards, where if I go into the repair shop and I use my credit card, well, 3% goes to the bank. So if the repair costs me $100, now the garage, owner only got $97, and then he buys something with his credit card, and then that person only has $94 or $93 and change, and then the next person, to the point where that $100, it's literally the banks are taking $50 or more of it out of the economy, which, we all knew they get their 3% cut, and, you know, that is what it is. But when it gets repeated in this fashion, that's something I don't think, many people think of. I know I didn't. And that has to have some sort of effect somewhere down the line. Not quite sure, but, and I'm sure that effect has already happened, but it's another interesting, financial wizardry that we live in.
Yeah, the bank is basically the house, and the house always wins. And there's all kinds of interesting money tricks that most people don't think in terms of. In the opposite direction, there's the multiplying effect of the money supply by putting your money in a bank. You put your money in the bank, and you have that money in the bank as far as you're concerned, but they take a nice percentage and they loan it to someone else, so all of a sudden there's more money in circulation, and they spend that money with other people who then put it in the bank, and then it multiplies again. So there's division going on, there's multiplication going on, but at the end of the day, the banks pretty much always win. And even if they don't win, they go crying to the government, and the government bails them out. And none of these guys ever spend a day in jail doing all kinds of things. The real estate bubble, the derivative bond, no one had to pay a price for that.
Yeah, unfortunately, our politicians are all complicit. I mean, that's the only explanation, that's for sure. Very interesting, very interesting. And just touching on another topic, and if anybody wants to jump in, please, I'm just keeping the net going here. But when you touched upon Rhea, I never got the full story with that. Was her whole disagreement with the ARL based upon salaries? That was my impression, but I really can't say I remember reading that or whatever. That was, like you said, there was some sort of disclosure things and people wanted to talk about it. And but was that your understanding? Was her grievance with the salaries being not in line with what they should be?
Well, as far as I'm aware, kind of what got her into trouble. That's not the reason they had for kicking her out, though. The reason that they gave for kicking her out was that she authored a FCC amateur radio license handbook. And I think they thought that that was not proper, since the ARRL published the same type of a book. So they used that as the excuse to kick her off the board.
As soon as you started saying it, yeah, I remember that. And I believe, and again, I don't want to put words in her mouth or put out any benefit. I believe she claims that she had run it by them first and got the verbal okay to nod, yeah. And so, okay, very interesting. But I know I went to one of these events, ham radio events, and there was a gentleman, I'm probably going back, oh, man, must have been 10 years ago, and he was the new ARRL president, and he was looking for some feedback, and he was very much touting that, you know, his business experience, and I think he said he was a CEO and this and that, and which is okay, but it kind of did make me, like, you know, move back and forth. I don't know. I thought the credentials we wanted was somebody who was a long-time ham with all of these awards and all of that stuff. But it's definitely moved in a different direction, a business direction.
Yeah, I remember the same thing. I think it was a little bit earlier, like 12 years ago. But, yeah, all of a sudden they all kind of woke up and decided that this was a business. And, you know, they've had to kind of take a step back, and then they take a step forward, and they end up in the same place. So, you know, it's just a matter of delaying it because there was just apparently too much resistance on the subject. But I don't know. The same guys are kind of doing the same push. So I assume it's going to get worse long before it ever gets better.
82 FIU.
Yes, George.
Affordable, like I said, our local representatives are all for us, and they try and work against, or not, and for us. They work for us. But I'll tell you, the top is, I don't like...
You fell out of the repeater, George. Yeah, I'm sure there are some who are for us, but I think there are some who are against us and with the board. Because, you know, I don't think they could have done it all by themselves. So, you know, there are good guys, there are, you know, not so good guys. That's, you know, I don't think it's kind of universal one way or the other, unfortunately.
Echo 2, Yankee Gulf.
Yes, Sam. Signal beautiful.
Thank you. the ARRL had was packed, and I think that really shook them up quite a bit. So I think that has an influence in the way they're conducting themselves these days.
I don't think so. They were hacked a couple of years ago. They've been pulling this business idea for about 12 years now. So unless they were time travelers, I don't think so.
Let me know when you're ready to discuss radio frequency in the shack. I'm having a difficulty.
Sure. I'm sure John will. John already said he was kind of done with his thing, and I can hear you, so it's perfect time to do it. So please share.
Today I used CW on the high frequency for the first time, and I did get out. I was spotted in Vancouver, Canada, so my signal was getting out. When I pressed the key, though, the lights in the shack flickered. So I'm concerned about what that means and what I should do.
It means that you're getting RF in your shack. You shouldn't have it. Your RF should be at your antenna site. And it's interfering with the control electronics of your lights and such. So what you have to do is try and figure out how the RF is getting into your shack. Make sure that, you know, the transmission line is working fine. And put some good old a toroid in line with the transmission line to block the common mode current that's coming back from your antenna feed point and into your shack.
KD2FRU, quick input.
Sure, George.
Thank you, Roy. Hello, Sam. I heard in your area there were some power problems with areas in that section of Brooklyn with underground power systems that were either losing power source or power negative, power grounding systems. So maybe just check it out tomorrow and let Con Ed do what they got to do.
Okay, so we'll give Con Ed a call and ask what they can check. The grounding in the area. Is that what you're suggesting?
Negative. Just sleep on it. Sleep on it. They have problems. I've been watching it on television, and it's in your area. And oh, by the way, I should have called you and let you know. I'm sorry.
Yeah, George?
I got to contact Sam, but in the meantime, the local people that run our ARRL contact, the whole thing about them, they are wonderful. They do the greatest job possible, and whatever I said about ARRL, I'm pointing right to the top.
Okay, but I recall where there were kind of directory fights, where there was a slate recommended by the board, and there were slates that decidedly were not recommended by the board. So, like most things, it's never 100% black or white. It's just kind of shades of gray.
I think that our local representatives on the first two levels are really with our interest.
Are you talking locally or are you talking nationally, like every low-level ARRL officer across the country are all on one side of this situation?
No, locally.
Well, I recently said this has come to our meeting. So it's the first meeting, he was very enthusiastic with the progress of the meeting.
Yes, he was a presence in our club for a while. He comes every so often, which is very nice of him. Anyway, getting back to you, if nothing comes of what George mentioned, again, if it's a flickering light that's kind of synchronized with your tapping CW, chances are, again, you're getting common mode into your shack. So there's no such thing as too many ferrites. So put some common mode chokes on the output on your transmission line, and block the common mode getting into your shack.
Will do. Will do. Thank you. Roy, will do.
You're welcome. Once again, this is AC2GS with the IMARC Technical Net. We got lots of time left if anyone wants to use it. We're still open for business. If you have any questions or comments or topics of interest, or you want to expand on something that was discussed earlier tonight, feel free to hit that push to talk.
WS2M.
Yes, Paul.
In regard to Sam's problem, years ago I had the same problem. I send CW and I could watch the lights dim every time you hit a did or a da. But also, if you had an air conditioner turn on or off, things tend to dim also. And it got worse as the years went by. So finally, eventually, contacting the PSE&G, they eventually found that there's a problem, with the wiring in the neighborhood, like what George was saying. And after a couple of months, they dug everything up, and we have underground service. Eventually, they straightened it all out, and when that was done, I never had another problem with sending CW watching the lights flash. So it could be a power problem, most likely, RF, of course, getting into the shack. But it's just something to consider. And, there's ways to test. You can find a battery source and plug your rig into a battery source temporarily if you can. And then transmit that way and see if the lights flash, and then you could really confirm whether or not it's RF or electrical.
Yeah, that's a great way of testing. It becomes somewhat technically more difficult the more power you run in your rig. If you're running a radio that takes 12 volts, and you can just use a lead acid or lithium iron phosphate, that's always a good idea to differentiate between utility problems and other situations. What kind of power were you outputting CW that caused the power to kind of blink on and off?
Is that question for Sam or me?
You. I was just curious because we know the source of your situation. I was just curious if it was a particularly, if you had a linear on it or it was just barefoot.
Oh, okay, I get it. Yeah, just barefoot, 100 watts, And then, of course, that was with the old power supply, too. I thought maybe that had something to do with it, but it wasn't. So, yeah, just 100 watts.
Sometimes if you have a real heavy load on one particular line, you can dim out, you lower the voltage across everything. Surprisingly, my linear amplifier never does that, but my laser printer does. When the laser printer, I turn it on and it goes through its heat cycle, the overhead lights dim by a small amount, but I can notice them. But thankfully, the linear amplifier can put out, 700-800 watts and doesn't seem to have that effect.
Okay, yeah, my neighbor had the same problem. You know, we were getting fed from the same big transformer, and he had the same problem. You know, any kind of electrical things you would turn on or off, things were flashing all the time in his house, worse than me. And, I mean, for a good couple of weeks, maybe, more than that, over maybe a month or 6 weeks, he had an external transformer that they hooked up to power his house, some kind of a jury rig setup that a power company did. You know, it takes a long time before they get permits and everything to really dig up everything. You know how that goes. So he had that whole temporary setup for quite a while. But eventually that all went away. It was four of us that really had a big problem. But that's all been fixed. Back to you.
Great. Well, all's well that ends well.
Yeah, I'm curious to find out if Sam's lights, you know, if it was a severe blinking or just slightly, you know, noticing it. And also, if he has LED lights, they're more sensitive to any kind of, you know, problems in the power line. You know, or is he running the old incandescent lights?
Okay, Sam, did you hear that?
I did not hear that. I talked to a George on a landline. I'm listening to him.
Okay, Paul was asking you whether you have an incandescent or LED and whether it's a kind of a slight dimming or stronger dimming. I guess he's still talking to George. The problem is, though, that LEDs are probably also very sensitive to RF because, you know, they have dimming controls and, you know, theoretically they're smart devices, so that they would suffer from RFI as well.
Yeah, I was blowing LEDs left and right when they first came out. Oh, this is a great idea. They're going to last for 20 years, you know. I put them in. A couple of months later, gone. Another one goes. I was changing them more than the incandescents, and it's all because of the power problem. But ever since that was fixed, I haven't changed an LED in here for years, and I have them all throughout the house.
Yeah, the technology isn't a great deal. The very early LED light bulbs had a lot of thermal issues. So if you enclosed the bulb, it overheated and burnt out. Or even if you changed the orientation, they were kind of designed to operate at particular angles. And if you happened to, you know, put it in a way where the heating element didn't get any kind of airflow, convection, it would overheat. So they had a lot of heat issues, but very few these days. They're very, very, very stable. But you get some where if you try and hook them up to the wrong dimmer switch, instead of just dimming, they flicker. So there's some incompatibilities with different dimmer electronics, even today. You got to be a little cautious, but they're getting better at it, so, you know, just a matter of time, I guess.
Yeah, I have a couple of these old swag lights in the house, you know. They're the ones that hang on a chain, you know, from a hook coming off the ceiling. And now those bulbs are 100% upside down, you know. And those were failing much quicker than the other ones. But again, you know, since I had the power problem straightened out, they're not failing either. But yeah, I agree. You put an LED upside down, especially the older ones, and a lot of heat gets into it. Like you said, they all have these globes that surround it, you know, and you're really trapping the heat. So, anyway, we'll turn it back to you, Roy. WS1.
Roy, I'm back.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Right, there is an LED light only in that one bulb that's doing the flashing, so that's one thing to look at. I like that. Appreciate that. George Knight is on the ground. The fact that the LED light I have is plugged into an ungrounded outlet, whereas everything else in the shack is grounded with, you know, with the three-pronged plugs and ground and whatever. So, the question is it that particular light that's due to its engineering that's taking the
Thank you. Okay, it'll be interesting to see how it turns out. I mean, it could simply be the particular control electronics of that LED that are sensitive to your surroundings. It's very possible you could swap it out with another model LED bulb and the problem will just go away. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yes, fun and games. It's a lot of fun, this hobby.
Yeah. I mean, it's best to kind of treat each problem as a challenge rather than just as a problem.
So once again, you educated me, Roy, and gave me some serious thoughts about a magnet on the keys and tackling this issue. So thank you again for being so interesting. Anyway, back to you, Roy. Thank you.
You're welcome, Sam. Thank you for your participation in our net. Once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We still have some free time if anyone wants to take advantage of it. If not, you know, we could have a short session tonight. It's not going to be the end of the world. So it's up to, I leave it up to you guys. If you got a question or a comment or a topic, feel free, wish to talk. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next segment. Okay, I guess the net has spoken by not speaking. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight, and I hope you'll come back next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. But started a little early, but that's okay. Paul, WS2N, why don't we do the SpaceNet report?
Yeah, we could do that. And if anybody has technical questions, you know, they could always come on board. None of us are going anywhere, hopefully. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Name is Paul. And, we cover anything new in the space world, whether it's from this country or another country, you know. And, of course, the main story, or the biggest story for this week is the up-and-coming Artemis 2 mission that's going to be heading to the moon. And presently it's scheduled for the 8th of February, coming up next week. They did plan on the 6th, but due to the cold weather, and the cold weather is getting down to Florida, and, you know, that affects everything. So they figured, you know, better be safe than sorry. We'll delay it at least a couple of days, and I wouldn't be surprised if they get delayed again, you know, either for weather or other technical reasons. But these four astronauts will be heading past the moon and then back. And they're going to go, you know, thousands of miles past the moon. And then they're going to return. They're not going to orbit it. So they call it a return. And the reason they do that is if something went wrong with their main engine to get them out of lunar orbit, they wouldn't have a problem getting back. So this way they don't go into orbit and they don't have that issue. So they'll have a, it's like a figure eight. As you head to the moon, you know, you look at the moon, you're going to go off to the left-hand side, and you're going to go past the moon, you're going to slow down a couple of thousand miles, and eventually the moon starts pulling you back. But then, you know, you don't hit the moon, you just come out around the other side, and you automatically head back to Earth. This was done with Apollo 13. They did a free return with that. They didn't have the capability of reigniting the engine, because that had literally blown out. So they couldn't light that. So it's a good way to do it. Anyway, the four people going, three of the four are ham radio operators, which is interesting. You have Reed Weissman, he's the commander. KF5LKT. You have Victor Glover, he's the pilot, and his call is KI5BKC. You also have Jeremy Hansen. He's not from this country, he's from Canada, but he's got an American call sign, because a lot of these guys get their call sign when they're training down in Houston. That's why a lot of them wind up with five calls. In this case, all three of these guys have five calls. So Jeremy Hansen is KF5LKU. And the only one that doesn't have it is Christina Cook. She does not have her ham license. I don't know why she never bothered to get it, but she's got plenty of experience in space, that's for sure. She spent almost a year in space purposely. She went to the International Space Station, and she pretty much knew she was going to stay up there for a year. So, you know, she's got a record for a woman for one long duration flight. Yeah. So Artemis 2 will launch from Launch Complex 39B. There's two 39 launch complexes down in Florida, 39A, 39B. They used them both for, you know, in the Apollo days, and they used them both on a regular basis for the space shuttle days. You know, sometimes they would launch from 39A, sometimes the shuttle would launch from 39B. And they really put in redundancy in those days especially. So they're still there, but the only difference nowadays is NASA pretty much gave away 39A to SpaceX to use. They've been using it now for years for their Falcon 9 launches, including the Falcon 9 Heavy launches. But 39B is reserved for the SLS missions. They were also going to use it for they were going to share it with Northrop Grumman. Northrop Grumman was building a launcher, but they decided to scrap that whole project, the Liberty system. So that went away. Now they're strictly using it for the Artemis flights. So far, they've launched one Artemis flight from that, and that was the unmanned flight that went around the moon and came back. Again, it didn't orbit the moon. Very similar to what's going to go on with this upcoming flight next week. So that was like a dress rehearsal. The only difference is that one didn't have a crew. And this one does. Any questions for now about this Artemis mission. WS to what? YDI, what is it? I always forget your call. Go ahead.
So if the weather's very cold in Florida, how long does it take for the systems to all warm up so that the launch isn't potentially compromised?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to get that cold. It's not like a... You know, what went on with the Challenger flight back in 86 when those giant O-rings cooled down so much it created an opening that allowed the exhaust, you know, to come out. Essentially created a blowtorch and burnt right through the hydrogen system. But, you know, that was, as far as I was concerned, was from, you know, cold weather. And that could cause other problems, too. So, they have heaters. In fact, they said that they put the heaters on in Orion a couple days ago, you know, run them intermittently. To keep things nice and toasty, they like to keep it at a certain temperature. So, if the temperatures get down too low, you know, of course, they're definitely going to scrub the launch, you know, before they even tried it to launch. You know, lessons learned. So I'm not sure what the number is, but I know that, what was it, January 28th when Challenger blew up. It was January, and it got way too cold, and I'm sure that was a contributing factor to that disaster. But back to you, N1YDI, WS1.
All right, Paul, thank you very much. That was my question. You know, I was thinking about the Challenger incident, and I didn't know how cold it was in Florida at this moment. But thank you very much, everyone. Whitey, white, clear.
Yeah, I remember pictures of the launch pad itself. You know, they showed, like icicles. That was really cold. I mean, it's not necessarily caused from the cryogenics. All this stuff is cryogenically cooled. You know, the liquid oxygen, the liquid hydrogen that's in the core tank. You know, they do drop those temperatures down. All the piping that goes with it. They have the fill lines. I think some of them are like 16-inch, 17-inch in diameter. But, you know, those things are all brought down to cryogenic temperatures. And now they're going to run through a dress rehearsal within, I think, a day or two. And what they do is they fill up the whole rocket with over 700,000 gallons worth of, combination between hydrogen and oxygen. You know, twice the amount of hydrogen and oxygen, you know, H2O. So, and the exhaust that comes out is actually, you know, steam. To launch, you know, they have to have those things at cryogenically cool temperatures. So, that's not the problem. But, other things, you know, like the O-rings on the solid boosters. If you look at the system, the SLS system is similar to the shuttle. On the port side and starboard side, they have the solid booster rocket attached And there's a difference, slight difference between the two, between shuttle and this one. Shuttle had the fourth that were attached, you know, one on top of one another, and each one has the O-rings. And this one has an extra section, so this one's longer, for the two solid boosters. They also put out a heck of a lot more thrust. I think it's 3.5 million pounds of thrust on each one, compared to, I think, around 3 million on the shuttle one. So, and they, you know, because they're taller, they're able to fly a little longer. Instead of the 2 minutes, I think it's 2 minutes and 40 seconds or something like that before they separate from the tank. And then the core stage continues on. The core stage has the four RS-25 engines attached. The RS-25 engines, they're the ones running the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. The solids run solid fuel. But those four engines are the same engines. In fact, some of them are exactly the engines that flew on a couple of the shuttles. When the shuttles came back and they retired them, they kept the engines and they refurbished these things to put out, instead of 100%, 109% each on each engine for each one of those RS-25 engines are actually putting out more thrust than shuttle. And there's four of them, where shuttle had three. So it's much more powerful when it launches. It's, what is it, 0.6, I think, 0.6 million pounds of thrust. With the shuttle was down in the 5 million plus category. So, that's how they get off the launch pad. And then the solids eventually separate it for a couple of minutes. The core keeps going with the four engines, putting out each engine is like 550,000 pounds of thrust. So, you're putting out a couple of million pounds of thrust until that fuel is exhausted. And then now that core is going to separate from the rest of the system. That's actually considered the first stage. That's going to separate. Of course, nowadays, why keep those engines? So they're going to go into the drink, where in the old days on the shuttle, they kept the RS-25 engines and reused them over and over again. And in fact, that's why they were able to push these engines to 109% thrust. It sounds like they're going overboard, but they know that these engines are going to be going up. It's once around the merry-go-round for these engines. So they don't care if they put out a lot more thrust. And, so now that separates, and then you have the internal or cryogenic propulsion stage. That's the second stage, above this whole setup. And that'll ignite. And that, again, is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And that's designed to put the spacecraft into orbit. That'll accelerate it to its orbital speed of 17,500 miles an hour. Then Artemis 2, along with the crew of 4, will orbit the Earth, I think they said around 4 or 5 times, as long as it takes, because they're going to check everything out. They're going to check out the breathing capability, the water, make sure everything, is working on board the spacecraft before they think about actually heading to the moon. So you know, check everything out. Check the bathroom out. They actually have a toilet on board this one, you know, with the door and everything. So, you know, make sure everything works. Make sure communications work. They have one antenna, a dish antenna pointing back to Earth. They'll be using that. S-band, all that. And once everything is okay, that second stage will eventually separate from the service module and the Orion space itself. So there's one engine attached to that. And by the way, I mentioned cryogenics on the second stage. Okay, so that one separates, that's gone, and now you have the this one engine. They call it the OMS engine, Orbital Maneuvering System engine, originally from, again, the space shuttle. In fact, I think the one they're using is also one of the ones that flew on a space shuttle. On space shuttle, you had two of these things, one on the port side, one on the starboard side, and they would be used for, especially for returning, coming back from orbit. They would ignite, slow the shuttle down, and then they would re-enter the atmosphere. They save these engines. They don't run on liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. They run on a hypergolic fuel. So when they start up, they mix with tetroxide, and they instantly ignite. You know, you don't need a spark plug. So the job of the service module OMS engine is to push them into TLI. TLI is translunar injection. Off they go to the moon. They'll start accelerating up to 25,000 miles per hour. Orbital speed is 17,500. They'll push it to 25,000 miles per hour, or roughly 7 miles a second, to get out of Earth orbit. And off they go for like 3 days flight to get close to the moon. And then, of course, beyond the moon, they're going to go, I forget how many thousands of miles past the moon, and then back again. The whole mission is 10 days, so they're going to do all kinds of science on board as well, you know, make sure everything is okay. They say the four people will be very busy. And sooner or later, you know, they'll return after going past the moon and back. They'll be heading to the Pacific Ocean. That's going to take around 3 or 4 days to get from them. The moon vicinity all the way to Earth. So, you know, after 3 days, the service module itself will separate from Orion's spacecraft. The service module will burn up with all the tanks and everything that was supplied. You know, that's where they're getting the water. That's where they're getting their power from. The service module has these four big solar panels on it, producing 11 kilowatts of power. So, you know, let's say if you have a generator at home like I do, you know, it's like mine's around 4 kilowatts. It's almost equivalent to like running three of my generators, and that's how much power these solar panels put out. They're really good. So, eventually that whole setup, solar panels, the fuel, the OMS engine, will eventually run up in the atmosphere. And the only thing left is the Orion spacecraft itself with the crew of four inside. You know, they'll turn and start heading into the atmosphere. On Artemis 1, it was a direct shot pretty much, where the heat shield would, you know, come in first and pretty much head right down to the Pacific Ocean. You know, it would get real hot, up to 5,000 degrees, and the stroke parachutes would come out, and then the big parachutes would come out after that, and the spacecraft landed successfully in the Pacific Ocean. So, you know, if you follow the stuff, if you follow it on the news, there are people worried about the heat shield itself. Call it AFCOAT. This AFCOAT is part of this heat shield. You know, it's supposed to ablatively burn, you know, little sparks, I mean, would slowly burn from the heat shield. That's the way we've been doing it for years with Mercury, Gemini, Apollo. Not shuttle, but all the other rockets. And it bleeds off the heat as these little sparks light off. What happened was, after it landed in the Pacific Ocean, it looked at it, and everything was charred. It didn't look that good. And the heat shield people got together, and they figured out what was wrong with it. It was made differently than the Apollo heat shield. Apollo heat shield, they coated the whole thing like one big piece. That was only roughly 12 and a half what, feet in diameter. This thing's 16 and a half feet in diameter. Much, much bigger. And they got the idea, well, let's make like a bunch of blocks of this stuff, and we'll put the blocks together. And it looks like about, I don't know, 100 of these blocks that are part of the heat shield. And they figured by doing this, it would be okay, but there was like little gaps in between. And that allowed, gases to develop when you heated it to 5,000 degrees. I got to put a fan on for my break here. Okay. And what happened was, it built up pressure, and a little pop here, a little pop there. And that's why it looked like the little pieces were missing, and they were not happy with the heat shield. So they got together, and they figured, we've got to lower the temperature as it comes through the atmosphere. We've got to keep it off this 5,000 degree temperature for long periods of time. And this system that they use, Apollo used it. In fact, shuttle used it too. You know, you enter the atmosphere, and then like a barnstormer, you just come through lightly, on an angle, and then you'll skid off back into space again. And if you do it just right, it's like I mentioned this last week, it's like taking a stone and skipping it on a lake. So now, you're going to go in, you're going to come back out, then you're going to go back in again. They might just do that two or three times. So you're separating the heating of the shield, a longer period of time, but it's not going to get up to the high temperature and stay there for a long period of time. And they think that this is going to be good enough, and they believe that they should be able to make it back to the Pacific Ocean in one piece. I hope that's the case, and I think that's probably what will happen. Now, Artemis 3, when that goes to the moon, they say that that's going to use a different kind of heat shield. They're going to make it, it's going to be made differently. Where they're going to eliminate that kind of possibility. So this way, on 3, 4, and 5, they'll be able to come barreling through, like they originally planned. But, we'll see. Only time will tell. Like I said, it's a 10-day flight, so, a couple of few weeks from now, if they get off the ground, anytime soon, we'll get an answer to on how that all went. Any comments for the net, WS2N? Okay. Anyway, nothing hard. But, yeah, they all have ham licenses. I wish they'd put a 2-meter antenna out there, and they could have...